Thank you so much for taking time to listen to this week's message. It's our hope that this resource will grow you in your faith, hope, and love for Jesus. Please help us get the word out by following us on social media and sharing resources just like this. And if this message has inspired you to take your next step in faith, please let us know by reaching out to us through social media or the church office. We are praying and believing that God will change you through his word today. Blessings.
So in my household growing up, my mom was a lover of the arts, and she exposed me to the arts pretty early. When I talk about arts, we got to be really clear, okay? We're talking about movies, all right? That's what I'm talking about, the arts. When I talk about movies, I'm talking about late 80s, early 90s movies, okay? It was just different back then. I'm talking about Indiana Jones stuff. I'm talking about just a different day and age. And what's interesting is that there's these movies you watch, especially those late 80s and 90s movies, that the parental censoring and controls, they didn't really quite figure that out yet as a society, all right, if you know what I mean? There was just some stuff in some of those PG-13 movies that I don't know we'd be calling them PG-13 anymore. You don't realize it until you become an adult. And I don't know if you've been there, if you've watched a movie that you saw as a kid, and you thought, this is going to be great, I'm going to show my kids this, and 5 minutes in, you're like, this is not okay to show to children, right? And I think, what were my parents thinking, okay? And so I don't know if that's been you. I had a great mom, but there was just some shady movies that maybe I probably shouldn't have seen at 8, okay? Now, one of those movies that definitely was okay, and I want to open up with this story today, is as I want to talk a little bit about Star Wars. So, and when you say the word Star Wars, you've got the fanatics that they're like, yes. Because listen, y'all, next Sunday is May the 4th. All right, and that's a whole thing for Star Wars people. I don't live in that space, okay? I'm not that crazy of a fan. Then you got some people that could care less, okay? And that's okay. It's a safe space this morning. But we did watch a lot of Star Wars growing up. And so, in my opinion, the best Star Wars movie is The Empire Strikes Back. I don't know if we have any Empire Strikes Back fans in here. The reason why that movie was such a big deal back in the 80s, okay, and listen, if I'm spoiling this movie for you, it came out in 1980, all right? This was 40 years ago. This is your fault, okay, if you don't know. But it was like the first time that they put a movie out there, and it's just like 120 minutes of the good guys just getting the trash kicked out of them. I mean, the whole movie is nothing but the bad guys winning, and people loved it. And so I want to give you a reference. There's a point to it, okay? There's a point to this rambling to kick off the service this morning. If you don't know anything about the movie, here's the quick synopsis. It starts off on this ice planet called Hoth. You got the heroes. You got Luke Skywalker. You got Princess Leia. You got Han Solo. You got Chewie. And they're being chased down by the Empire and the main bad guy, Darth Vader. And they're trying to get this Rebel Alliance snuffed out. And so end up they have to split ways. So we got Han and Leia and Chewie. They go to get some help. And then our boy Luke, he goes to find little Yoda to become a Jedi, you know, master and to take down the evil Empire. And so the whole movie is their journey. And it comes together in the end in Cloud City where Darth Vader, our guy Darth Vader, has set this trap to get Luke in. And it works. And so him and Luke, they have this incredible lightsaber battle. It was way better than the first movie's lightsaber battle. Okay, like they had got the FX up a little bit. And then there's this moment where they're going back and forth. And then Darth Vader, gangster style, just knocks Luke's hand into infinity. And then there's this moment where he says something to Luke that is, it's big. It's never really been done at this point in movie history, is that the big climatic moment, Empire Strikes Back, is where Darth Vader reveals to Luke that he's his father. And what is our hero's reaction? He goes, no, it's so whiny. And I was like, you know what? I'm Team Empire. Just take Luke out. This is not how a hero should respond, right? And so then Luke escapes Darth Vader. He heads out. And then we head into the third movie in a couple years. And it's all balanced out. You go, Adam, why would you waste the first 5 minutes of your talk with this? That moment in that movie was scandalous. If you were watching that, you would have been, what just happened? How can the main bad guy be the father of the hero? It was absolutely scandalous. And I don't know about you, but I love stories like that. I love a story, whether it's a book or a movie or a TV show, where you think you know what's happening. You can predict it. Okay, in the Myers household right now, we're raising teenage girls, and we are into the 90s rom-com scene. Every night is a 90s rom-com in the Myers household, okay? I fought it at first, and then I just gave in, okay? So I'm in, right? But, like, every 90s rom-com's the same. I mean, I predicted one of the movies 5 minutes in. I looked at my wife. I said, this is exactly what's about to happen. And it did. I was right. But I love a story where you think you know what's going to happen, and then all of a sudden, it changes. And so for the next 5 weeks, we are going to press into a story just like this. We are going to talk about a story that Jesus gives in Luke 15. And it's the kind of story, get this, it's the kind of story that gets you killed. Now, growing up as a church kid, I always thought one of the craziest things about Jesus was they did not kill Jesus for what he did. They killed Jesus because of what he said. Because when you read the scriptures, listen, Jesus did some crazy stuff. Stuff that just didn't make sense at a human level. Like Jesus turned water into wine. Jesus took a kid's sack lunch and he fed thousands of people. Jesus walked up to dead people and said, "Stop being dead." Now, you don't kill that guy, all right? Like, that's the guy you want on the team. You want the guy that raises people on the dead on your team. You don't kill that guy. But in the end, what you find when you read the Gospels is that they didn't kill Jesus because of what he did. They killed him because of what he said. And this story that Jesus tells, this is one of those things. And so before we get into the story, we're going to have to do a little bit of work. So we're going to be hanging out in Luke 15, verse 1. We've got it up here on the screen. And here's the first line. It says this. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, drawing near to Jesus. And so the first thing we got to do to really set the tone for the next 5 weeks is we got to talk about the people in the audience because they matter. Now, when I say the word tax collectors and sinners, let's just be real. In 2025, that ain't moving any of us, right? We don't feel moved by that. We don't feel offended. We don't feel inspired. Like, it's just words. But in the first century, when you say the word tax collector and the word sinner, that does something to you. Now, and I get it, right? It's a little outdated for us because my guess is that your understanding and my understanding of what a tax collector is probably came from a Sunday school song. All right, so anybody ever sing about a guy named Zacchaeus? Anybody ever sing that song? It's okay if you're a church kid. You can raise that and be proud. It's okay. That's how we know about Zacchaeus, right? And what was Zacchaeus? He was a tax collector, but we really know Zacchaeus was a wee little man, right? And a wee little man was he, okay? And so that's who Zacchaeus was. And so Jesus shows up in the Gospels, in Zacchaeus' town. He's a tax collector, and Zacchaeus wants to see Jesus. So what does he do? He climbs up a sycamore tree, right, for the Lord he wanted to see. And he hears Jesus preach, and then Jesus does the unthinkable. Jesus walks up to Zacchaeus, and he says, "Hey, Zacchaeus, come down." Why? "For I'm going to your house today." Right? That's how we sang it, okay? That's how we learned it, right? Because that's what he said. He said, "I want to hang out at your house today. I want to spend time with you." Now, if that's not resonating with you because you're like, "Hey, I've never sang that song before in my life." Okay, that's fine. Maybe what you know about tax collectors is from the history books. Tax collectors, specifically during this time, were very shady people. So their job would be to, for instance, collect $20 from you. But what they would do is they would take 30 because they had the backing of Rome. So they would show up and say, "Hey, give me 30. I'm only supposed to give 20. I don't care. Give me 30. They would take your 30 bucks. They'd give Rome their 20. They'd pocket the 10. That's kind of how tax collectors work. But it's not just the fact that these guys were shady. What we need to understand is Rome. At this period of time, you need to understand something. Rome ruled the world from England to India. England to India. That was the landmass that Rome operated in. Now, listen, that is not a problem for the United States of America. Okay, if any one of the states in the Union decided today that they had enough of D.C. and that they were going to secede from the nation and start the second civil war, that's not a problem for Washington. Like Washington's not like, "Well, let's get some guys on horseback. 6 months, hopefully we get there in time and can shut this thing down before it's a problem." I'm telling you right now, some guy named Steve is going to type in a code, hit enter, and they're gone. Whoever they are, they're just gone off the map. That's how we fight wars in 2025. That is not how you fought war in the first century. Rome, being as big as they are, they don't have that luxury. So if you're Rome and you've got a massive army, if there was a problem in one part of your kingdom, it could take 6 months to get troops there. I mean, that thing could be over by the time you get there. So how do you govern a landmass that big? You got to have a big army. And how do you feed a big army? Taxes. Now, Rome was an incredibly brutal regime. Like, Rome would show up to your city. They'd crucify 100 people and line the streets with them just to prove a point. That's who Rome was. So Rome shows up. They take over your town. They abuse your people. And guess who they hire to tax you? Your neighbor. So I don't know if you got this growing up as a kid reading the scriptures, but everybody got so angry at Jesus hanging out with tax collectors. It wasn't because Zacchaeus was a wee little man. It's because Zacchaeus worked for a really brutal regime. And so now you kind of get the idea of why people hated tax collectors. And then there's this other group hanging out with the tax collectors, and they're called sinners. Now, sinners, you got to understand something about sinners, because it's important. It's all a part of what we're trying to build. A sinner wasn't what you did. A sinner was who you were. To be called a sinner, you were a class of people. And this class of people, there was a pretty messy bucket of them, and they were deformed, diseased, and destitute people. We're talking about lepers, liars, and prostitutes. Sinners. And so if you were a sinner, you were classified as a person as a sinner. Matter of fact, when it came to sin in the first century, they would blame you being a sinner on either you or something that happened to your parents. So if a family had a child and that child was born with a disability, a physical disability, an emotional disability, whatever it is, they would ask the question, well, who sinned? Must have been the parents that sinned for this to happen. And then that kid, for the rest of their life, would be classified as a sinner. Not seen for who they are, but seen for what they lacked. And so you got some dirty, dirty people in this crowd, y'all. You got some tax collectors and you got some sinners. But there's another group that Jesus talks to in this section. And Luke brings them up. Luke 15, verse 2 says this. And then the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So there's another group of people. So one side of the room, we got tax collectors and sinners. On the other side of the room, we got Pharisees and we've got scribes. Now, the best way I can talk to you about what a Pharisee is in the first century is this, and I say this with love. Pharisees, they're just better than you and they're better than me. A Pharisee knows more Bible than you. A Pharisee prays more than you. A Pharisee has better morals than you, and they have better morals than me. A Pharisee is just better than us. For starters, to be considered a Pharisee in the first century, you had to have the Torah memorized. That's the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Hey, show of hands. Anybody ever get through the book of Numbers? Some of y'all, you're overachievers. I'm telling you right now, every year, Bible in the Year plan, I'm like, I'm going to do it. Numbers is going down, and it gets me every year. You know what? John. Okay, like, I just can't. Like, it's, these guys had it memorized, word for word. Now, listen, you might go, listen, I don't have Numbers memorized, but I think I'm crushing it in my faith. Maybe you are. Maybe you're the kind of person, you get up at 5 a.m. to pray. Every t-shirt you have says, "I love Jesus," and every coffee cup has a verse, okay? I'm telling you, friend, these guys, they're better than you. If a Pharisee was hanging out with us, they'd be like, "What time did you get up to pray?" 5 a.m.? Boy, I haven't slept all week, been praying all week. Like, that's the kind of people these were, like, just different. And so on one side of the room, you got the broken, the sick, and the sinful. On the other side of the room, you got these Pharisees. And in the middle, you got Jesus. And he's about to tell a story that is going to wreck both of them. And so he picks up the story in Luke 15, 11. And he said, "There was a man that had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he, the father, divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had, took a journey into a far-off country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything." Now listen, if you want to talk about scandalous, that's what's just happened in the first couple sentences of this story that Jesus is speaking, and everybody in the crowd knows it. This is scandalous. For the son to walk up to his father and say, "I want my inheritance now," that is incredibly inappropriate. And the reason why is that during this period of time, if you were a good father, you would leave an inheritance to your children. But that inheritance would only be received if you died. But once you died, you left the inheritance and you took care of your children and their children's children. And so what's happening in this moment is this young son, he is walking up to his dad and he says, listen, I don't want you. I just want your stuff. It would be better for me if you were dead. So I could take what was mine and I could go do what I wanted to do with my life. I don't want to be a part of this family and I want to go. That is scandalous. That is inappropriate. And here's what's crazy. The father gives it to him. He does it. He actually gives it to him. I'm telling you right now, I wouldn't have done that. I would not have done that. The son doesn't make the rules. The son doesn't determine the household. My kid walks up to me and says, give me my stuff. I go, no, go to your room. I will beat you. Like this is, I would not do that. And I think what we find in the father is something that we will miss in our relationship with God. Is that there is an aspect, you need to get this, there is an aspect of God's love for us that he will sometimes let us exhaust ourselves. Romans 1 talks about how sometimes God will let you and I run after what we think will satisfy us only to discover that it can't. And there's grace in that. And so this father, he looks at his son and he says, go. Go run. Here's your inheritance. You can go. And I think it's important that we stop and we think about this, because that there are some of us in this room that despite all the mistakes we've made, we still think that we know better than God. That our reaction at times to the leading of the Holy Spirit is that, you know what, I'm just not sure you know what you're doing. I mean, I get it. You spoke creation into existence, God. I get it. There's nothing on this earth that you can't point to and go, that's mine, that's mine, that's mine. Even my life, you can point to it and go, that's also mine. But I think this little area of my life right here, I think I'm good. I think I know what to do here, that we still think at times that we know better than God. And so the father, he says, go run, go exhaust yourself. And shocker, our boy makes some bad financial decisions, all right? He ends up squandering his inheritance on reckless living. And then at the end of verse 16, we find this young son hiring himself out, feeding pigs. And you know how we know it's bad? He longs for what the pigs are eating. How bad has that got to be? That you want to long for the garbage that you're feeding the pigs because your life's so bad. And so then, something incredible happens in verse 17. Something happens that changes the entire story. In verse 17, it says this, but when he came to his senses... When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And I think that one of the tragedies of life is this, is that some of us were just not sick of ourselves yet. We are just not sick of ourselves yet. That we believe deep down in us that somehow we're still the hero of our story. And I love what Jesus is showing us here in love and grace. Is that simply, historically, not true. And if you don't believe me, just take a moment this afternoon and think about your life. My guess is there is nobody in your life that has lied to you, let you down, disappointed you, or hurt you more than you. Nobody has. And despite the fact that we think somehow we're gonna get good enough to become the hero of our story, that if we just try harder, we're gonna somehow turn the mess around. How's that working out? How's the try harder plan going? Some of us, we've been doing it for a while, haven't we? We just keep saying to ourselves, you know what, tomorrow it's gonna get better. Tomorrow, if I just try a little harder. Next week, when life doesn't get so crazy. Next year, when things finally get straightened out. We just keep telling ourselves that it's going to work, and chances are, and I know this is where I've been so many times, that you're probably not where you thought right now today. Where you are right now is probably not where you thought you'd be. That my guess is that there were some promises you made to yourself a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and that you fell short on those promises. That's my guess. I can be honest and say I've done that. I've sat in those spaces. I've taken that long car ride and thought through those things. I've sat down at bed at night, and I've not been able to sleep thinking about those things and thinking, man, how did I mess it up so bad? I thought for sure I was going to get it right this time. And if you live long enough, you're going to taste this bitter truth. Stuck hurts worse than scared. Stuck hurts worse than scared. And the only way that change happens is when you and I, we begin to come to our senses and realize, I don't think I've got this. I don't think it's working out. And that's what Jesus is trying to shift the audience into. It. So he's trying to shift us into this idea of change. Taking a step of faith to see change. And I get the fact that that is terrifying for some of us in this room. But I, as a friend, I need you to know something. That if you think the price of change is too high, well, wait till you get the bill of regret. That's way more expensive. So in verse 17, our boy, he comes to his senses, face down in the pig mess, thinking, what am I doing with my life? He realizes that working at a servant in his dad's house, that's way better than this. And he says, listen, I blew it as a son, but I am not too ashamed to beg for a job. And he gets up, and he heads home. And what does he do? Scripture tells us that what? He practices the speech. He starts practicing speech. Now listen, if you don't know what that means when I say practice the speech, then you didn't have a lot of fun in high school, okay? Practice the speech meant you broke the rules, okay? You stayed out too late. You went to that one friend's house you shouldn't have gone to. You saw the movie you shouldn't have been. You did something that you weren't supposed to do. You're coming home, and mom and dad are sitting at the top of the stairs. That, and you better have a good speech, right? Like, it better be good, because your life, you know, your social life is going to depend on what you're about to say. And if you're really good at the thing as a teenager, like, then you knew which parent to talk to. Like, I was really good. I knew exactly which parent to talk to. Shocker, it was my mom, okay? If it was my mom, I mean, I could... Baby boy could sweet talk himself out of a lot of stuff, okay? And so you got to know the parent, you got to know the speech. So he's heading home and he's practicing the speech. Now, this is important because at this moment, the crowd starts to lean in because they want to know. If you're a sinner and a tax collector, and all you've ever heard your whole life is how broken you are and how the God of this universe doesn't want anything to do with you because of your sin, aren't you wondering in this moment, what's it going to take? What's it going to take to get right with God? What does penance look like? How much is it going to cost me to get back in the good graces of the Father? That's what you want to know if you're on this side of the room. Now, if you're a Pharisee or a scribe, what are you saying? Get him, Jesus. Man, this sermon better preach. Yeah. I mean, they're ready for it. You better let them know what it's going to cost to get back in the graces of the Father. You better let them know where they stand in the eyes of God. And what comes out of Jesus' mouth are some of the most scandalous and most beautiful words in all of Scripture. In verse 20, he says, and he arose and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet and bring the fattened calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. What? Yeah, what? This is out of control. The son goes, give me my money. And the father gives him his money. The son blows it all, and he comes to his senses. He comes crawling back to dad, and from a distance, his father sees him, has compassion on him, runs to him. And you get this, that when he gets to the son, not only does he embrace his boy, but he doesn't even accept the speech. And it's a pretty good speech. He doesn't even accept the speech. He says, shut up, ring, robe, steak. Like, this is unbelievable. And you read it and you go, this is too far. This is inappropriate. This is scandalous. This is grace. This is grace. And when I read this, I think to myself, man, how crazy is this story? Because if you're a first century Jew, a tax collector and a sinner and a Pharisee, this is unbelievable. Everything that Jesus is saying, this is not cultural norm. It is unbelievable, because if what Jesus is saying is actually true, it would completely redefine what everybody in this circle understands about God. My guess today is that you walked into this room with a certain understanding about God. And there has been some things that have shaped it. And I wish for all of us, our testimony would be that I have a healthy, loving understanding about the God of the universe, because I have had nothing but healthy, loving relationships my entire life. But my guess, friend, is that's not your testimony. And I love what Jordan said today, that Jordan says that sometimes you come in church and you don't even feel like you should be here, don't even feel like you're able to sing, don't even feel like you should pray and talk to God, because somewhere along the lines, that got shaped. It got shaped by broken people and broken situations in your life. And Jesus steps into this space and he tells a story that if it's true, if this is true, Jesus, they're both looking at Jesus, they're in shock. The Pharisees and the sinners and the tax collectors, they got the same reaction. Jesus, if this is true, if what you're saying about God is true, this changes everything we know about God. And Jesus is saying, yes, I have come to redefine grace. I have come to rewrite history. And you know what I love about the Bible? Is that the Bible always recognizes how crazy the gospel is. It recognizes it. It never hides away from the fact. Like when you look at that and go, that just sounds unbelievable. The Bible goes, yeah, it is kind of unbelievable, but it's true. And what I love about that is Paul in 2 Corinthians 5, he addresses that when he says this. If we are out of our mind, as some say, it is for God. But if we are in our right mind, it is for you. For Christ's love compels us, because we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died. And he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. I love what Paul's saying here. He's saying, listen, I know this sounds crazy, that what we're saying is this man named Jesus, God, stepped into flesh. He lived life on this earth for 33 years. He died for the sins of the world. And then in 3 days, he kicked the end out of the tomb and he rose from the grave. He goes, I know it sounds crazy, but if it's true, that would change everything, wouldn't it? Paul would later go on in Corinthians to tell us that after he did it, Peter saw that he was resurrected, 500 saw that he was resurrected, the disciples saw that he was resurrected, James saw that he was resurrected, and then he goes on to say, and me, I saw the resurrected Savior. I saw him live. He goes, it's true. And it changes everything. So what does that mean for us this morning as we start to wrap this up? Paul goes on in verse 17. This means that anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new person. The old life is gone, a new life has begun, and all of this is a gift from God, who brought us back to himself through Christ, and God has given us this task of reconciling people to him.
For God was in Christ, reconciling the world to himself, no longer counting people's sins against them. And he gave us this wonderful message of reconciliation. So we are Christ's ambassadors. God is making his appeal through us. We speak for Christ when we plead. Come back to God. Because God made him who had no sin to be sin for us so that we could be made right with God through Christ. So everything I've said has honestly to get us to this moment right here. Everything I've said is to get us to this moment right here. What I'm about to share next is the most important 90 seconds I've got this morning, all right? So I just need you to lean in. Here's what Paul's saying. Here's what compels him. That Jesus became like us so that we could become like him. Jesus became like us so that we could become like him, which means this, that you don't have to stay stuck in your shame anymore. You don't have to stay there. That Jesus can rewrite your story. That's the point of this message. Is that there is no sin in your life, friend, that can out-sin the work of the cross. And so, the hope that I have, the hope that you have in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus is this. Your worst thing doesn't have to be your last thing. That's the power of the resurrection. Your worst thing doesn't have to be your last thing. I'm going to close with one more story and then we're going to get you guys out of here. So, back in the days of America where we didn't have a highway, interstate system, we were a little bit more advanced than horses and we had trains. And there used to be these people called train preachers. They were evangelists who would hop on a train, they would ride to town and they would do a revival, and then they'd hop on the train, ride to the town and do a revival, and this is what they did. And so there was this one man, and he was one of the most famous train preachers. His name was Mr. Ravensbury. And that's what Mr. Ravensbury's job was. He was a pastor that would ride the train, stop in towns, and preach the gospel. And so Mr. Ravensbury was between towns. He got on a train one day, and it was just him and this young man sitting in this train car. Mr. Ravensbury said that when he looked in the corner, this man was clinging to this torn up cardboard suitcase. And he was distraught. So Mr. Ravensbury, he's a preacher, so he just does what preachers do. And he walks over and he goes, "Excuse me, sir." He goes, "I'm a preacher and I can tell that something's on your mind." He goes, "Do you want to talk?" Ravensbury said it was like opening a spigot full blast. This kid just unloaded his whole life story. He said, "Mr. Ravensbury," he said, "a couple years ago, I was living at home with my parents, and as I was becoming a man, I just kept butting heads with my dad. And it started off with little arguments, and then it got bigger, and then at some point, it just felt like we couldn't get along, we couldn't be in the same space, and finally, we had this big fight one day. And I told my dad, I said, well, maybe I'll just move out. Maybe I'll go do this on my own. And he said, my dad looked at me and he says, if you think you could do it on your own, go ahead. So he said, I ran upstairs in my anger and I packed everything I had in this cardboard suitcase. And right before I walked out the door, my dad said to me, hey, if you walk out that door, don't you ever come back. He said, Mr. Ravensbury, that was 2 years ago. He said, I have made a mess of my life. He said, I've been from town to town, and he goes, this next stop is probably going to have to be my last. But last week I wrote a letter home to my parents, and I apologized for all the things I said. And I asked them if it'd be okay for me to come home. And you see, Mr. Ravensbury, this train passes my house. And in the letter, I told my parents that if it would be okay to come home, that the big oak tree in front of the house, if they felt like it was okay, could they just tie a white sheet in the tree? And then I know it'd be okay, but if there was no white sheet, then I know, just keep on going. He said, Mr. Ravensbury, we're about 10 minutes away from my house, and I don't know what I'm going to do if there's nothing white in that tree. So they sat together and they waited, and as they started around that turn, that young man said, Mr. Ravensbury, would you care to look out that window for me? Because I just don't think I can. So Ravensbury pressed his face up against that glass. He would later say that when the train rounded the corner, it was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen in his life. There wasn't just one white sheet on that tree. It was covered from the top to the bottom. The family had emptied out the entire linen closet. And by the time he turned around to tell the son to look, he was already off that train. He said, by the time the train rounded the corner, the last thing he saw was this kid dragging an empty case into the arms of his parents. In church, the cross and the empty tomb, that is heaven's way of emptying out the linen closet and saying, I don't care what you've done. I don't care what you've where you've been. You can come home. You can come home. So this morning, as we get ready to close out this service, I'd invite you to pray with me. And if you wouldn't mind, just bow your heads for a second. Here's what's going to happen. We're going to have just a prayer, and then we're going to have a response that we're going to sing together as a closing prayer. But if you're here today, you might go, Adam, well, then what do I do with this information? And I wonder this morning that maybe you might be here, and maybe your story is similar to the story of the prodigal. Maybe you got lost. And you never thought in a million years you could come home. And maybe today is a reminder that no matter what you've done, you can come home. But maybe you're here today and you've not quite ran away from home, but you haven't really quite been living for God. And you just maybe feel like, because of the choices you've made, that you can't talk to God. You can't get into his presence. And maybe today that you would be reminded that that is simply not true. But maybe you're here today, and as we speak about prodigals, you are somebody that loves and follows Jesus, and you know some prodigals in your life that need the love of Jesus. And maybe today you would be encouraged to reach out to those people. Regardless of where you are today, here's what I want to say before we pray, is that because of the empty tomb, because of the cross, is that the worst thing in your life doesn't have to be the last thing. And so if that's you today, and you just need some time with the Father, we just want to give you some space here, that I would invite you, if you're a prodigal, right now just to pray and just to ask and say, God, I have wandered. I have ran. And right now, right here in this moment, I am asking that, God, that you would restore my heart. That, God, that you would help bring me back home.